when you strain your energy to its utmost in order to produce the best? Do you expect to be rewarded for it or punished? Reardon did not answer. By every standard of decency, of honor, of justice known to you, are you convinced that you should have been rewarded for it? Yes, said Reardon, his voice low. Then, if you were punished instead, what sort of code have you accepted? Reardon did not answer. It is generally assumed, said Francisco, that living in a human society makes one's life much easier and safer than if one were left alone to struggle against nature on a desert island. Now, wherever there is a man who needs or uses metal in any way, Reardon metal, has made his life easier for him. Has it made yours easier for you? No, said Reardon, his voice low. Has it left your life as it was before you produced the metal? No, said Reardon, the word breaking off as if he had cut short the thought that followed. Francisco's voice lashed at him suddenly as a command. Say it. It has made it harder, said Reardon tonelessly. When you felt proud of the rail of the John Galt line, said Francisco, the measured rhythm of his voice giving a ruthless clarity to his words, what sort of men did you think of? Did you want to see that line used by your equals, by giants of productive energy such as Ellis Wyatt, whom it would help to reach higher and still higher achievements of their own? Yes, said Reardon eagerly. Did you want to see it used by men who could not equal the power of your mind, but who would equal your moral integrity, men such as Eddie Willis, who could never invent your metal, but who would do their best, work as hard as you did, live by their own effort, and riding on your rail, give a moment's silent thanks to the man who gave them more than they could give him? Yes, said Reardon gently. Did you want to see it used by whining rotters who never rouse themselves to any effort, who do not possess the ability of a filing clerk, but demand the income of a company president, who drift from failure to failure and expect you to pay their bills, who hold their wishing as an equivalent of your work and their need as a higher claim to reward than your effort, who demand that you serve them, who demand that it be the aim of your life to serve them, who demand that your strength be the voiceless, rightless, unpaid, unrewarded slave of their impotence, who proclaim that you are born to serfdom by reason of your genius, while they are born to rule by the grace of incompetence, that yours is only to give, but theirs only to take, that yours is to produce, but theirs to consume, that you are not to be paid neither in matter nor in spirit, neither by wealth nor by recognition, nor by respect nor by gratitude, so that they would ride on your rail and sneer at you and curse you, since they owe you nothing, not even the effort of taking off their hats, which you paid for. Would this be what you wanted? Would you feel proud of it? I'd blast that rail first, said Reardon, his lips white. Then why don't you do it, Mr. Reardon? Of the three kinds of men I described, which men are being destroyed and which are using your line today? They heard the distant metal heartbeats of the mills through the long thread of silence. What I described last, said Francisco, is any man who proclaims his right to a single penny of another man's effort. Reardon did not answer. He was looking at the reflection of the neon sign on dark windows in the distance. You take pride in setting no limit to your endurance, Mr. Reardon, because you think that you are doing right. What if you aren't? What if you're placing your virtue in the service of evil and letting it become a tool for the destruction of everything you love, respect, and admire? Why don't you uphold your own code of values among men as you do among iron smelters, you who won't allow 1% of impurity into an alloy of metal? What have you allowed into your moral code? Reardon sat very still. The words in his mind were like the beat of steps down the trail he had been seeking. The words were, the sanction of the victim. You, who would not submit to the hardships of nature, but set out to conquer it and place it in the service of your joy and your comfort, to what have you submitted at the hands of men? You who knew from your work that one bears punishment only for being wrong, what have you been willing to bear and for what reason? All your life you have heard yourself denounced, not for your faults, but for your greatest virtues. You have been hated. Not for your mistakes, but for your achievements. You have been scorned for all those qualities of character which are your highest pride. You have been called selfish for the courage of acting on your own judgment and bearing sole responsibility for your own life. You have been called arrogant for your independent mind. You have been called cruel for your unyielding integrity. You have been called antisocial for the vision that made you venture upon undiscovered roads. You have been called ruthless for the strength and self-discipline of your drive to your purpose. You have been called greedy for the magnificence of your power to create wealth. You who've expended an inconceivable flow of energy have been called a parasite. You who've created abundance where there had been nothing but wastelands and helpless starving men before you have been called a robber. You who've kept them all alive have been called an exploiter. You, the purest and most moral man among them, have been sneered at as a vulgar materialist. Have you stopped to ask them by what right, by what code, by what standard? No, you have borne it all and kept silent. You bowed to their code, and you never upheld your own. You knew what exacting morality was needed to produce a single metal rail, but you let them brand you as immoral. You knew that man needs the strictest code of values to deal with nature, but you thought that you needed no such code to deal with men. You left the deadliest weapon in the hands of your enemies, a weapon you never suspected or understood. Their moral code is their weapon. Ask yourself how deeply and in how many terrible ways you have accepted it. Ask yourself, what is it that a code of moral values does to a man's life and why he can't exist without it, and what happens to him if he accepts the wrong standard by which the evil is the good? Shall I tell you why you're drawn to me, even though you think you ought to damn me? It's because I'm the first man who has given you what the whole world owes you, and what you should have demanded of all men before you dealt with them, a moral sanction. Reardon whirled to him, then remained still, with a stillness like a gasp. Francisco leaned forward as if he were reaching the landing of a dangerous flight, and his eyes were steady, but their glance seemed to tremble with intensity. You're guilty of a great sin, Mr. Reardon, much guiltier than they tell you, but not in the way they preach. The worst guilt is to accept an undeserved guilt, and that is what you have been doing all your life. You have been paying blackmail, not for your vices, but for your virtues. You have been willing to carry the load of an unearned punishment, and to let it grow the heavier, the greater the virtues you practiced. But your virtues were those which kept men alive. Your own moral code, the one you lived by but never stated, acknowledged, or defended, was the code that preserves man's existence. If you were punished for it, what was the nature of those who punished you? Yours was the code of life. What then is theirs? What standard of value lies at its root? What is its ultimate purpose? Do you think that what you're facing is merely a conspiracy to seize your wealth? You who know the source of wealth should know it's much more and much worse than that. Did you ask me to name man's motive power? Man's motive power is his moral code. Ask yourself where their code is leading you and what it offers you as your final goal. A viler evil than to murder a man is to sell him suicide as an act of virtue. A viler evil than to throw a man into a sacrificial furnace is to demand that he leap in of his own will, and that he build the furnace besides. By their own statement, it is they who need you, and have nothing to offer you in return. By their own statement, you must support them because they cannot survive without you. Consider the obscenity of offering their impotence and their need of you, as a justification for your torture. Are you willing to accept it? Do you care to purchase at the price of your great endurance, at the price of your agony, the satisfaction of the needs of your own destroyers?
No,
Mr. Reardon, said Francisco, his voice solemnly calm. If you saw Atlas, the giant who holds the world on his shoulders, if you saw that he stood, blood running down his chest, his knees buckling, his arms trembling, but still trying to hold the world aloft with the last of his strength, and the greater his effort, the heavier the world bore down upon his shoulders, what would you tell him to do?
I don't know. What could he do? What would you tell him?
To shrug. The clatter of the metal came in a flow of irregular sounds without discernible rhythm, not like the action of a mechanism, but as if some conscious impulse were behind every sudden, tearing rise that went up and crashed, scattering into the faint moan of gears. The glass of the windows tinkled once in a while. Francisco's eyes were watching Reardon as if he were examining the course of bullets on a battered target. The course was hard to trace. The gaunt figure on the edge of the desk was erect. The cold blue eyes showed nothing but the intensity of a glance fixed upon a great distance. Only the inflexible mouth betrayed a line drawn by pain.
"Go on," said Reardon with effort. "Continue. You haven't finished, have you?"
"I have barely begun." Francisco's voice was hard.
"What are you driving at?"
"You'll know it before I'm through. But first I want you to answer a question. If you understand the nature of your burden, how can you—" The scream of an alarm siren shattered the space beyond the window and shot like a rocket in a long, thin line to the sky. It held for an instant, then fell, then went on in rising, falling spirals of sound as if fighting for breath against terror to scream louder. It was the shriek of agony, the call for help, the voice of the mills as of a wounded body crying to hold its soul. Reardon thought that he leaped for the door the instant the scream hit his consciousness. But he saw that he was an instant late, because Francisco had preceded him. Flung by the blast of the same response as his own, Francisco was flying down the hall, pressing the button of the elevator, and not waiting, racing on down the stairs. Reardon followed him, and watching the dial of the elevator on the stair landings, they met it halfway down the height of the building. Before the steel cage had ceased trembling at the sill of the ground floor, Francisco was out, racing to meet the sound of the call for help. Reardon had thought himself a good runner, but he could not keep up with the swift figure streaking off through stretches of red glare and darkness. The figure of a useless playboy he had hated himself for admiring. The stream, gushing from a hole low on the side of a blast furnace, did not have the red glow of fire, but the white radiance of sunlight. It poured along the ground, branching off at random in sudden streaks. It cut through a dank fog of steam with a bright suggestion of morning. It was liquid iron, and what the scream of the alarm proclaimed was a breakout. The charge of the furnace had been hung up, and breaking, had blown the tap hole open. The furnace foreman lay knocked unconscious. The white flow spurted, slowly tearing the hole wider, and men were struggling with sand, hose, and fire clay to stop the glowing streaks that spread in a heavy gliding motion, eating everything on their way into jets of acrid smoke. In the few moments which Reardon needed to grasp the sight and nature of the disaster, he saw a man's figure rising suddenly at the foot of the furnace, a figure outlined by the red glare, almost as if it stood in the path of the torrent. He saw the swing of a white shirt-sleeved arm that rose and flung a black object into the source of the spurting metal. It was Francisco D'Anconia, and his action belonged to an art which Reardon had not believed any man to be trained to perform any longer. Years before, Reardon had worked in an obscure steel plant in Minnesota, where it had been his job, after a blast furnace was tapped, to close the hole by hand, by throwing bullets of fire clay to dam the flow of the metal. It was a dangerous job that had taken many lives. It had been abolished years earlier by the invention of the hydraulic gun. But there had been struggling, failing mills which on their way down had attempted to use the outworn equipment and methods of a distant past. Reardon had done the job, but in the years since, he had met no other man able to do it. In the midst of shooting jets of live steam in the face of a crumbling blast furnace, he was now seeing the tall, slim figure of the playboy, performing the task with the skill of an expert. It took an instant for Reardon to tear off his coat, seize a pair of goggles from the first man in sight, and join Francisco at the mouth of the furnace. There was no time to speak, to feel, or to wonder. Francisco glanced at him once, and what Reardon saw was a smudged face, black goggles, and a wide grin. They stood on a slippery bank of baked mud, at the edge of the white stream, with the raging hole under their feet, flinging clay into the glare where the twisting tongues that looked like gas were boiling metal. Reardon's consciousness became a progression of bending, raising the weight, aiming, and sending it down, and before it had reached its unseen destination, bending for the next one again, a consciousness drawn tight upon watching the aim of his arm to save the furnace, and the precarious posture of his feet to save himself. He was aware of nothing else, except that the sum of it was the exultant feeling of action, of his own capacity, of his body's precision, of its response to his will. And with no time to know it, but knowing it, seizing it with his senses past the censorship of his mind, he was seeing a black silhouette with red rays shooting from behind its shoulders, its elbows, its angular curves, the red rays circling through steam like the long needles of spotlights, following the movements of a swift, expert, confident being whom he had never seen before except in evening clothes, under the lights of ballrooms. There was no time to form words, to think, to explain, but he knew that this was the real Francisco d'Anconia. This was what he had seen from the first and loved. The word did not shock him, because there was no word in his mind. There was only a joyous feeling that seemed like a flow of energy added to his own. To the rhythm of his body, with the scorching heat on his face and the winter night on his shoulder blades, he was seeing suddenly that this was the simple essence of his universe, the instantaneous refusal to submit to disaster, the irresistible drive to fight it, the triumphant feeling of his own ability to win. He was certain that Francisco felt it too, that he had been moved by the same impulse, that it was right to feel it, right for both of them to be what they were. He caught glimpses of a sweat-streaked face intent upon action, and it was the most joyous face he had ever seen. The furnace stood above them, a black bulk wrapped in coils of tubes and steam. She seemed to pant, shooting red gasps that hung on the air above the mills, and they fought not to let her bleed to death. Sparks hung about their feet and burst in sudden sheafs out of the metal, dying unnoticed against their clothes, against the skin of their hands. The stream was coming slower, in broken spurts, through the dam rising beyond their sight. It happened so fast that Reardon knew it fully only after it was over. He knew that there were two moments. The first was when he saw the violent swing of Francisco's body in a forward thrust that sent the bullet to continue the line in space. Then he saw the sudden, unrhythmic jerk backward that did not succeed, the convulsive beating against a forward pull, the extended arms of the silhouette losing its balance. He thought that a leap across the distance between them on the slippery, crumbling ridge would mean the death of both of them. And the second moment was when he landed at Francisco's side, held him in his arms, hung swaying together between space and ridge over the white pit, then gained his footing and pulled them back. And for an instant, still held the length of Francisco's body against the length of his own, as he would have held the body of an only son. His love, his terror, his relief were in a single sentence. "Be careful, you goddamn fool!" Francisco reached for a chunk of clay and went on. When the job was done and the gap was closed, Reardon noticed that there was a twisting pain in the muscles of his arms and legs, that his body had no strength left to move, yet that he felt as if he were entering his office in the morning, eager for 10 new problems to solve. He looked at Francisco and noticed for the first time that their clothes had black-ringed holes, that their hands were bleeding, that there was a patch of skin torn on Francisco's temple, and a red thread winding down his cheekbone. Francisco pushed the goggles back off his eyes and grinned at him. It was a smile of mourning. A young man with a look of chronic hurt and impertinence together rushed up to him, crying, "I couldn't help it, Mr. Reardon," and launched into a speech of explanation. Reardon turned his back on him without a word. It was the assistant in charge of the pressure gauge of the furnace, a young man out of college. Somewhere on the outer edge of Reardon's consciousness, there was the thought that accidents of this nature were happening more frequently now, caused by the kind of ore he was using, but he had to use whatever ore he could find. There was the thought that his old workers had always been able to avert disaster. Any of them would have seen the indications of a hang-up and known how to prevent it. But there were not many of them left, and he had to employ whatever men he could find. Through the swirling coils of steam around him, he observed that it was the older men who had rushed from all over the mills to fight the breakout, and now stood in line being given first aid by the medical staff. He wondered what was happening to the young men of the country. But the wonder was swallowed by the sight of the college boy's face, which he could not bear to see, by a wave of contempt, by the wordless thought that if this was the enemy, there was nothing to fear. All these things came to him and vanished in the outer darkness. The sight blotting them out was Francisco d'Anconia. He saw Francisco giving orders to the men around him. They did not know who he was or where he came from, but they listened. They knew he was a man who knew his job. Francisco broke off in the middle of a sentence, seeing Reardon approach and listen, and said, laughing, "Oh, I beg your pardon." Reardon said, "Go right ahead. It's all correct so far." They said nothing to each other when they walked together through the darkness on their way back to the office. Reardon felt an exultant laughter swelling within him. He felt that he wanted in his turn to wink at Francisco like a fellow conspirator who had learned a secret Francisco would not acknowledge. He glanced at his face once in a while, but Francisco would not look at him. After a while, Francisco said, "You saved my life." The thank you was in the way he said it. Reardon chuckled. "You saved my furnace." They went on in silence. Reardon felt himself growing lighter with every step. Raising his face to the cold air, he saw the peaceful darkness of the sky and a single star above a smokestack with the vertical lettering, Reardon Steel. He felt how glad he was to be alive. He did not expect the change he saw in Francisco's face when he looked at it in the light of his office. The things he had seen by the glare of the furnace were gone. He had expected a look of triumph, of mockery at all the insults Francisco had heard from him, a look demanding the apology he was joyously eager to offer. Instead, he saw a face made lifeless by an odd dejection. "Are you hurt?"
"No."
"No, not at all." "Come here," ordered Reardon, opening the door of his bathroom. "Look at yourself. Never mind, you come here." For the first time, Reardon felt that he was the older man. He felt the pleasure of taking Francisco in charge. He felt a confident, amused, paternal protectiveness. He washed the grime off Francisco's face. He put disinfectants and adhesive bandages on his temple, his hands, his scorched elbows. Francisco obeyed him in silence. Reardon asked, in the tone of the most eloquent salute he could offer, "Where did you learn to work like that?" Francisco shrugged. "I was brought up around smelters of every kind," he answered indifferently. Reardon could not decipher the expression of his face. It was only a look of peculiar stillness, as if his eyes were fixed on some secret vision of his own that drew his mouth into a line of desolate, bitter, hurting self-mockery. They did not speak until they were back in the office.
"You know," said Reardon, "everything you said here was true. But that was only part of the story. The other part is what we've done tonight. Don't you see? We're able to act. They're not. So it's we who will win in the long run, no matter what they do to us."
Francisco did not answer. "Listen," said Reardon, "I know what's been the trouble with you. You've never cared to do a real day's work in your life. I thought you were conceited enough. But I see that you have no idea of what you've got in you. Forget that furnace of yours for a while and come to work for me. I'll start you as a furnace foreman any time. You don't know what it will do for you. In a few years, you'll be ready to appreciate and to run D'Anconia Copper." He expected a burst of laughter, and he was prepared to argue. Instead, he saw Francisco shaking his head slowly as if he could not trust his voice, as if he feared that were he to speak, he would accept. In a moment, he said, "Mr. Reardon, I think I would give the rest of my life for 1 year as your furnace foreman. But I can't."
"Why not?"
"Don't ask me. It's a personal matter." The vision of Francisco in Reardon's mind, which he had resented and found irresistibly attractive, had been the figure of a man radiantly incapable of suffering. What he saw now in Francisco's eyes was the look of a quiet, tightly controlled, patiently borne torture. Francisco reached silently for his overcoat.
"You're not leaving, are you?" asked Reardon.
"Yes."
"Aren't you going to finish what you had to tell me?"
"Not tonight."
"You wanted me to answer a question. What was it?"
Francisco shook his head.
"You started asking me, how can I... how can I what?"
Francisco's smile was like a moan of pain, the only moan he would permit himself.
"I won't ask it, Mr. Reardon. I know it."
Chapter 4. The Sanction of the Victim. The roast turkey had cost $30. The champagne had cost $25. The lace tablecloth, a cobweb of grapes and vine leaves iridescent in the candlelight, had cost $2,000. The dinner service, with an artist's design burned in blue and gold into a translucent white china, had cost $2,500. The silverware, which bore the initials L.R. in empire wreaths of laurels, had cost $3,000. But it was held to be unspiritual to think of money, and of what that money represented. A peasant's wooden shoe, gilded, stood in the center of the table, filled with marigolds, grapes, and carrots. The candles were stuck into pumpkins that were cut as open-mouthed faces, drooling raisins, nuts, and candy upon the tablecloth. It was Thanksgiving dinner, and the three who faced Reardon about the table were his wife, his mother, and his brother.
"This is the night to thank the Lord for our blessings," said Reardon's mother. "God has been kind to us. There are people all over the country who haven't got any food in the house tonight, and some that haven't even got a house, and more of them going jobless every day. Gives me the creeps to look around in the city. Why, only last week, who do you suppose I ran into but Lucy Judson? Henry, do you remember Lucy Judson? Used to live next door to us up in Minnesota when you were 10, 12 years old. Had a boy about your age. I lost track of Lucy when they moved to New York. Must have been all of 20 years ago. Well, it gave me the creeps to see what she's come to. Just a toothless old hag wrapped in a man's overcoat panhandling on a street corner. And I thought, that could have been me but for the grace of God."
"Well, if thanks are in order," said Lillian gaily, "I think that we shouldn't forget Gertrude, the new cook. She's an artist."
"Me, I'm just going to be old-fashioned," said Philip. "I'm just going to thank the sweetest mother in the world."
"Well, for the matter of that," said Reardon's mother, "we ought to thank Lillian for this dinner and for all the trouble she took to make it so pretty. She spent hours fixing the table. It's real quaint and different."
"It's the wooden shoe that does it," said Philip, bending his head sidewise to study it in a manner of critical apprehension. "That's the real touch. Anybody can have candles, silverware, and junk. That doesn't take anything but money, but this shoe, that took thought."
Reardon said nothing. The candlelight moved over his motionless face as over a portrait. The portrait bore an expression of impersonal courtesy.
"You haven't touched your wine," said his mother, looking at him. "What I think is you ought to drink a toast in gratitude to the people of this country who have given you so much."
"Henry is not in the mood for it, mother," said Lillian. "I'm afraid Thanksgiving is a holiday only for those who have a clear conscience." She raised her wine glass, but stopped it halfway to her lips and asked, "You're not going to make some sort of stand at your trial tomorrow, are you, Henry?"
"I am."
She put the glass down. "What are you going to do?"
"You'll see it tomorrow."
"You don't really imagine that you can get away with it?"
"I don't know what you have in mind as the object I'm to get away with."
"Do you realize that the charge against you is extremely serious?"
"I do."
"You've admitted that you sold the metal to Ken Daniger."
"I have."
"They might send you to jail for 10 years.
"I don't think they will, but it's possible."
"Have you been reading the newspapers, Henry?" asked Philip with an odd kind of smile.
"No."
"Oh, you should."
"Should I? Why?"
"You ought to see the names they call you."
"That's interesting," said Reardon.
He said it about the fact that Philip's smile was one of pleasure.
I don't understand it, said his mother. Jail? Did you say jail, Lillian? Henry, are you going to be sent to jail?
I might be.
But that's ridiculous. Do something about it.
What?
I don't know.